support comes from the Arizona Inn, a Four Diamond, family-owned historic resort hotel and restaurant on Elm Street near the U of A. Information is at arizonainn.com.
Hello, everyone. I'm Tucson Weekly and Tucson Local Media Executive Editor Jim Nintzel, and we're here to talk Zona Politics on KXEI 91.3 FM. My guest today is Tucson author Todd Miller, who has written Border Patrol Nation and Storming the Wall. His new book is Empire of Borders, the expansion of the U.S. border around the world. This new book examines how the nature of the U.S. borders have changed and how these boundaries have effectively expanded thousands of miles outside the U.S. territory to encircle not only American land, but also Washington's interests. Todd, welcome to Zona Politics.
Thank you so much for having me.
Todd, you write in the introduction here that the idea for this book came to you back in 2012 during a trip to Puerto Rico. Talk a little bit about what you saw there and how that kind of germinated this book those many years ago.
Yeah, it was 2012, and I was actually on a research trip for the first book that I wrote, Border Patrol Nation. And I went to Puerto Rico, and I was quite surprised when I was on the west coast of Puerto Rico to see the same green striped Border Patrol vehicles that we see so often here in southern Arizona. And not only one or two, but a number of them that were doing patrols. And then to learn more and more about how those patrols work, not only on the west coast, and those of the west coast of Puerto Rico looks out onto the Mona Strait, which if you cross the Mona Strait, you end up at the Dominican Republic. So it's really, the policing of the waters between the Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico. And then, so that was, to me, was the first startling thing. And then I interviewed a park ranger who worked on the Mona Island. And the Mona Island is a U.S. territory about 30 miles away from the Dominican coast. And lo and behold, not only had he told me that he had been deputized for immigration, if somebody landed on the Mona Island and they didn't have documents, well, he was obligated to arrest them. There was also a place where the Border Patrol would come. Again, the same forest green uniform Border Patrol that we see in Arizona. So I was startled to realize that the U.S. Border Patrol quite literally can expand itself all the way to 30 miles from the Dominican coast. And that really was, thinking about that and thinking about that kind of elasticity or the expansion was really what got me first thinking about Empire Borders, or thinking that, wow, there could be a book written about that. And it was soon thereafter I went over to Dominican Republic and I saw that there was also a new attaché from the Customs and Border Protection in Santo Domingo, and they were coordinating the formation of a new border patrol in the Dominican Republic to then patrol the divide between the Dominican Republic and Haiti. And so on, and that's where it all started. I would really say that I started writing that book at that moment, even though I really didn't, right? I didn't have a contract, or I didn't have a publisher or anything like that. But that's when the wheels started turning, thinking about, there could be a book here.
What did you discover as you explored this idea more about where the borders, where these things were happening all around the globe?
I just started looking into it more and more. And by the time I sat down and really started researching this book, and that was probably in 2015, 2016. By that time, I knew that there was quite an international program, but I didn't even realize the extent of it then. It's literally, I guess, one way you can explain it. If you want to, you could like shut your eyes and stand in front of a map of the world and, point randomly and whatever country your finger ends up randomly landing on, most likely some sort of program has come from the United States around their borders or immigration enforcement. That's how extensive it is. So if you, and it's really, really, really started building up in the post 9/11 era, because there was no such thing as a Customs and Border Protection attaché in an embassy before then. And now there's 23. So those they've built up, and they, and of course they always want to have more and more. So now there's 23 attachés. There's at least, you know, more than 100 countries where programs have been implemented and to varying degrees, right? And for example, the Mexico program is huge, and it comes through various tributaries, including like the Department of State programs, Department of Defense programs. The one in Central America is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and I spent quite a bit of time in both of those places. But I also, it's not limited to this side of the globe. What I found is that it's all over the world. And I went to places like the Middle East and Africa and the Southeast Asia, and wherever I went, you know, I just picked different countries to go to, really, but I could have went to other ones. Like I went to Kenya, I went to Morocco, I went to Jordan, to the Jordan-Syrian border, I went to Israel and Israel-Palestine, I went to the Philippines, and just, you know, the extent of it was more than, it was a surprise to me to learn the extent of it and how much it's grown in the post 9/11 era. So much that I think that's one of the strategies, the pushing out of the border is one of the strategies that we really got to look at, you know, when you're looking at US border policy, along with all the other different strategies and policies that are implemented today.
In your last book, Storming the Wall, looked at how climate change is driving migration all around the world, and you definitely pick up that string in this book, and we are certainly seeing a different type of border crosser here in Arizona and all along the southwest border as more families from Central America arrive here, as opposed to what we used to see, which was men from Mexico or perhaps further south seeking employment, but planning to probably go back to their countries. Can you talk a little bit why so many families in Central America are coming to the United States?
Of course, there's multiple reasons. There's always multiple reasons why people come and north, and that the same, that's the case for Central America. People coming from Central America, from Guatemala, from Honduras, from El Salvador. Each of those places has different, considerably different challenges that are happening, especially for the people, the most marginalized people in those countries. And there's political challenges. There's economic, you know, model challenges, and there's an increasing what we could call an ecological dynamic, or if you will, you could look at it in a, there's a number of crises. If you're talking about Central America, there's definitely a political crisis, or a crisis of violence, a crisis of an economic crisis, and then what you have coming that's increasing, especially in the last 10 years. In places like Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador, is the increasing ecological catastrophe sometimes, especially, but not limited to, small farmers, like small farmers in Western Honduras, small farmers in the highlands of Guatemala, small farmers that are in what is known as the dry corridor of these countries. And it's known as the dry corridor because of, actually, it's a term that really 10 years or 15 years ago, it didn't even exist. And now this area is known for more and more, or less and less, I should say, rain. And rain when farmers will plant their seeds and the rains will not come. And next thing you know, crops are wilting. And you're talking about like some of the poorest people, economically speaking, in these countries. And so there's no cash to back them up. And all of a sudden, they're in a total crisis. For example, the World Food Program, last summer, when the droughts hit Central America, the rains didn't come. They estimated that 2 million people were impacted by the lack of rain, and it would be a food crisis for over 1.4 million people. So that's a huge swath of the population. Again, what people do is individual decisions, and you're not sure, but that does play into like people making decisions to possibly head north and to the United States, to, you know, arriving across the border in Arizona, for example, and not only single people, but entire families at times. Of course, again, there's multiple factors, and sometimes there's a confluence of things coming at once. Sometimes there's a climate incident, but then there's an incident of security, but also an incident of economics, all impacting the people. But, you know, that all these things, but the climate change aspect of it is something that definitely needs to be looked at with clear eyes.
Talk a little bit about the role of technology in all this border expansion.
Yeah, technology, as you know, in Empire of Borders, I look at the technology aspect, not only in terms of how it is deployed on the border. For example, in southern Arizona, we have, I believe, over 40 now, and I don't know the exact number, but it's a significant dynamic, the role of technology. I look at it even through the eyes of the industry, the growing global technology industry. So you can look at it and how it's deployed, and you can see, you know, right here in southern Arizona, how the different technologies are being deployed, and they're deployed in similar ways across the globe. But like right here, for example, we have a system of towers that have been going up in southern Arizona for the last couple of years by a private company by the name of Elbit Systems of America, which is a subsidiary of the Israeli company Elbit Systems. And they've been building integrated fixed towers. And these towers have cameras that can see 7.5 miles away. They have ground sweeping radar. They have night vision, thermal energy, camera capabilities, and all the towers work in tandem together, and they go into command and control centers where agents, and actually in the case of Arizona right now, National Guard soldiers are looking at monitors watching, you know, border crossings or the desert or different areas like that. And that sort of technological system of a virtual wall, so to speak, is being implemented in many different ways around the globe. You know, another example, and you can go clear across the globe from here to the Jordan-Syrian border, and the same exact sort of system is being built, and this time by Raytheon Corporation. They got the main contract to build like the integrated fixed tower system, but right along the Jordan-Syrian border, so you have the same sort of towers that can see long distance and at night, and the same command and control centers, and that sort of thing. So these, like, idea of virtual walls and of radars and cameras and sensor systems, they are all, like, deployed maybe in different ways in different places, but they're all being utilized across the globe. And they're fueling what is an ever-growing global industry around surveillance technology.
You also look at how Customs and Border Patrol is now examining the phones and other devices of visitors to the United States, including journalists and even U.S. reporters who are returning to the United States from reporting abroad. Number one, has this happened to you? Have you been hassled in this manner? And number two, can you talk about some of the experiences of the people you've talked to about this?
Yeah, unfortunately, it hasn't happened to me yet. Sometimes I expect it to happen. I've had the faithful X over my face a few times when you get to a kiosk coming from abroad, and the X over, it's always kind of creepy to see your photograph and then an X over your photograph, and then you get funneled in to talk to another person, different than everyone else is talking to. But I've never had anything happen to me beyond that, just a few cursory questions, and I'm on my way. But that other journalists and lawyers and activists, especially in the last year or so, but even before then, there's been a number of incidents of border crossings, of land crossing, crossing in the terms of arriving from abroad someplace into an airport, where people have been taken into secondary, being questioned, their phones demanded of them, the passwords to unlock the phones have been demanded of them. In Empire of Borders, I profile one journalist from Canada named Ed Wu, who was heading to Standing Rock in November of 2000, or I think it was October of 2000, either November or October of 2016, to cover what was going on there. He was going through the Vancouver airport. So he's in Canada, he's in Vancouver. And in Vancouver, they have one of the pre-clearance sites. A pre-clearance site is basically a site where Customs and Border Protection is stationed in the airport. And there's about 15 of them around the world So you actually enter, if you get through the preclearance site, you enter the United States. There's a welcome to the United States sign after you get through. In his case, he was taken into secondary inspection. They asked for his phone. He said he's a journalist. He has many sources on the phone. He refused to hand over his phone for that reason. He refused to hand over his passwords. And 7 hours later, he was told he would not be allowed in the United States. So a photojournalist was not allowed to go and cover Standing Rock. And that's just one case of many, many cases that are like that. And just the last comment, one of the things I did look into was this thing that's expanded called the National Targeting Center of Customs and Border Protection. And basically any person, whether you're a citizen or not, entering the United States on a foreign flight, you're pre-examined before you get into the United States. So they have a big thing called a targeting center. It's located in Virginia. It's the size of about 2 football fields. And before 9/11, there was no such thing. So this is an example of how this has grown. And they scrutinize every single person that's coming into the United States. They look at the profiles. Of course, they red flag certain people, and so certain people have alerts on their passports or something like that, and then taken into secondary. But this is a part of this kind of pushing out of the border again, this use of and using technology and biometrics and trying to scrutinize people and containers or objects before they come to the United States.
We're just about out of time, but I'm wondering, there seem to be almost conflicting forces at work here between a push for globalization and the corporate level and the financial level and a push for stronger borders when it comes to migration of people.
Yeah, there is. You could say that there is open borders for capital and money and finance and companies to cross borders, you know, to places like Mexico, like Central America, different companies like maquila factories or mining companies or that sort of thing. And there's a free pass. But at the same time, say a person who might even just be displaced by such actions, right? A person living in a town where a mine has taken over, where their water has been contaminated, as has happened in some towns in Zacatecas, Mexico, where then people can't drink their own water. And that could be one of the reasons that they leave and maybe even come to the United States. And those are the people who are blockaded. So you have, on one hand, a blockade of, you have an open border policy for money and corporations and finance and the elites, right? And then on the other hand, for the people most vulnerable or most impacted often by such policies, the borders have been shut, closed down, or it becomes much more difficult for those people to cross borders.
All right. The book is Empire of Borders, The Expansion of the U.S. Border Around the World. We've been talking with the author, Todd Miller of Tucson. Todd, thank you so much for joining us here on Zone of Politics.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure to be on.
And we'll be back in a few moments with another author, Becky Masterman.
Zone of Politics is made possible with the generous support of The Loft Cinema, Tucson's independent movie theater. The Loft features independent, foreign, and documentary films, cult classics, discussions with filmmakers, and much more, including the Loft Film Fest in November. The Loft is located at 3233 East Speedway Boulevard. Showtimes can be found at loftcinema.org.
And we're back with Zona Politics. My guest now is Becky Masterman, who has just published a new crime thriller, We Were Killers Once. It's actually the fourth book in a series featuring retired FBI agent Bridget Quinn. And Becky, welcome to Zona Politics.
It's awfully nice to be here, Jim.
And this is the latest, as I said, in a series of novels. Your first one won the Edgar Award for Best First Novel, the CWA Gold Dagger Award for Best Crime Novel of 2013, the ITV Thriller Award, and the McCavity, Barry, and Anthony Award. So you really picked up a whole bunch with that debut. Then this is the fourth one in this series. Talk a little bit about your protagonist here, Becky Quinn. I'm sorry, your name is Becky. Bridget.
Well,
Bridget.
Some people do say that it's me, and maybe it is an alter ego. I'm quickly approaching 70 years, and I moved out here to Tucson and challenged my husband to write a book just for the fun of it in Novel Writing Month. So we both wrote a novel, and I called mine One Tough Broad. And it was about an aging woman who's retired, but she's still sort of coming of age because she never really lived in the world that everybody else lives in. And she's still vital and strong. You know, she jokes that she can kill a man with her bare hands. And it was just fun being that person. It's still fun being that person. Even though I've never killed anyone.
Oh, that at least you're willing to admit to here on the radio. And this book, your new one, We Were Killers Once, plays off of the murders documented in Truman Capote's famous book, In Cold Blood. But it imagines there was a third killer. And tease our audience here about what this novel's all about.
Well, you know, I was trying to figure out what to write about, and I was talking to my agent, and she said, I've always wondered, you know, what a story like that would be about if there was a third person that night at the Clutter House, along with Dick Hickok and Perry Smith. And I said, oh my God, that's brilliant, even though I had never actually read In Cold Blood. So I picked it up, and I thought, what if that third killer is in this book somehow, and he's just never been discovered? And I found him on page 207, I remember. There is a long story that Perry Smith tells Capote about picking up this young 12-year-old kid and his grandfather. And he goes on for a good four pages. And as a newspaper man, you'll appreciate what it means to give that much space to something as insignificant as picking up a hitchhiker. The boy is unnamed, but he became my villain.
Oh, and as the novel takes place, he's actually getting out of jail and concerned that there might be some evidence linking him back to this, and he ends up crossing paths with your protagonist.
He does, because he worries at first that forensic science has emerged, and there will be some evidence with semen that he's left and a bloody palm print that he's left. And he also finds out that Bridget's husband, now Bridget is my protagonist, remember, he finds out that Carlo, Bridget's husband, was a prison chaplain and might have a document that implicates him not only in the famous murder of the Clutters, but also in the murder of the Walker family, which is a true story, which is unsolved to this day.
And you've really crafted a fascinating antagonist here in Jerry Beaufort. And what was fun about developing a villain in a book like this?
I have always, or very often, read books, the standard thrillers with villains, and the guy is always black on black. Everything about him is bad. He never has any doubts about anything he's done. But Jerry Beaufort, throughout the book, tries to convince himself that he was only a killer that once, because that was when he enjoyed it. And whenever he's killed since then, it's only by necessity. So he doesn't think he's a real killer. Right, he keeps telling the reader? That's right, isn't it?
And talk a little bit about what got you started in writing crime thrillers. Well, you talked about the NaNoWriMo,
you know the term for it.
Yes,
yeah.
National
and
Novel
I, well,
Writing
you know,
Month. Yeah,
I had written literary books up until then and was never able to sell anything. And this time I thought, well, since I'm just doing it as a lark with my new husband, I'll write a mystery. So I got a bunch of mysteries out of the library and read them, and I thought, oh, I want a character, a detective who is older but still vital. And I didn't see that kind of character in any book that I'd read. And that was what caught on with the reading public that I do have.
Well, are crime thrillers something you said you pulled a bunch out of the library, but before that, was this a genre that you enjoyed reading? Are there, you have favorite authors in this particular corner of the literary world?
I hadn't read a lot of thrillers, no, and but there I am.
Here you are. I mean, this is really, I mean, this is a fascinating retirement career for you that you've, you know, managed to strike gold with four books in a series like this. And what were you doing before you started with the fiction?
Well, I worked for a publisher, oddly enough, and the last job I had with the publisher was commissioning books in forensic science and law enforcement. So I had spent a good 10 to 15 years talking to all of the people who you see on television reporting on certain crimes. And it was a fascinating world. And part of Bridget Quinn's character, my protagonist, emerges from all of these people I had met who would joke while they were showing these bloody slides in their conference talks. And I thought, these people all have post-traumatic stress disorder. And so that's part of what's in Bridget's character too. Everything that she's seen and has had to deal with. And that's why I called my first book Rage Against the Dying. It's not just the Dylan Thomas poem. Bridget is raging against all of the dying she's ever seen.
And that's a lot of, that's something I think people are so much more acutely aware of now, this whole idea of PTSD and how working in these kinds of fields can really cause a lot of psychological damage to people.
They have to
kind of figure out a way to manage.
And I love these people that I met. Some of them are very angry. They express it that way. And some, like, I know one forensic anthropologist who says she tries to view life in paleontological terms. That if she sees the world as, you know, 40,000, 50,000, 60,000 years old, she can deal with the mass grave that she's standing in now.
Oh, my goodness. That's just heartbreaking. In so many
it
ways
is.
To hear, you know, the impact of doing this kind of work on folks.
It's really wonderful that there are people out there who do it.
Yeah. So your first book, you mentioned NaNoWriMo. That's the November, the National Novel Writing Month, and folks are encouraged to write a book in 1 month. Just bang it out and get it over with. And you mentioned you and your husband both sat down for this challenge. You ended up with a published book, it sounds like.
I did, but it took a while because the first time I wrote the book in 2004 and sent it out to five agents, and they all said nobody wants to read about a woman older than 40.
Oh, dear.
So I just put it aside, and then it was the strangest thing. It was the Oscars of 2008, and Jack Black is up on stage singing something. In the middle of his performance, he points at Helen Mirren and shouts, "Helen Mirren, you're hot." And I jumped up off the couch because I thought, this is our time. It's boomer time. And I sent the book out again in 2008 to a couple of agents, and one of them called me back and said, "I haven't finished the book yet, but I've been looking for this character for years."
No kidding.
And that's how it started.
How much revision did you have to do, you know, with the draft you knocked out in that 1 month?
Oh, how much revision?
Yeah, did you have to rework it significantly from there?
Yeah, the book that I sent the agent was about a kidnapping plot and the art world. And by the time she sold me to St. Martin's, I had to write a whole new book.
Oh, my goodness.
They said that they loved the character of Bridget Quinn, but she needed a bigger story.
Ah.
And I said, "You want a serial killer, don't you?" And they said, "That would be nice."
Yeah, everybody wants a serial killer these days.
So yeah, so I wrote a whole new book. And even that went through about three or four different revisions.
Yeah, so it wasn't just a 30-day struck gold situation.
Oh, no.
Well, so nonetheless, I mean, my goodness, what a fascinating story about, you know, authors obviously face a lot of barriers as they're trying to get their books published, and this sounds like a really fascinating origin story of
Well, it takes a lot of perseverance, and you just have to love putting the lines down.
You mentioned you moved to Tucson with your husband, and how long have you guys been in Tucson?
We moved here around 2004. Let's see, that's 15 years. We were both in South Florida, and started dating. And I had known him for a long, long time. And at that particular time, we'd both been single for a while. And he said, "Would you like to move out to Tucson with me? I'm retiring." And by the way, Bridget's husband in the books is an ex-Catholic priest who turned into a philosophy professor. And my husband really is an Episcopal priest.
Oh, no kidding. So you're
yeah.
definitely writing what you know. And you, but you are not an retired FBI agent.
No, I just know a lot of them.
You know, this has been such a delight talking with you about this book, We Were Killers Once. If you're just joining us, our guest has been Becky Masterson talking about her new crime thriller, We Were Killers Once, fourth book in the series about retired FBI agent Bridget Quinn. Becky, thank you so much for joining us here on Zona Politics, and best of luck with the book.
It's been my pleasure, Jim. Thank you.
Support for Zona Politics is provided by Hotel Congress in historic downtown Tucson. Hotel Congress is known for its world-famous taproom, Cup Cafe, and Club Congress, offering local and national acts inside and outside on the plaza. More information at hotelcongress.com and 622-8848.